Hello, everyone. Welcome to Measuring the Score podcast, the podcast where we offer our opinions on film scores and the films they're inspired by. I'm Chris.
And I'm Leslie.
Let's get started. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Measuring the Score. I am very excited about this score. Do you know why, Leslie?
You like trains?
I do like trains, but that's not the reason why.
Aw. It's like I don't even know you.
I know. And, you know, who did I marry?
Who are you again?
No, this film is one of my go-to films. I talked about this on our last episode. I have a list of films. Number one is Ready Player One.
Why haven't I seen this list?
I don't know.
Is it mental list or do you physically have it written down
somewhere? No, it's not a physically written down list. It's a mental list.
Oh, okay.
Everybody has a mental list of their go-to movies.
Nah, I don't know about that.
Are you sure? You don't have a go-to movie?
No, I flip through channels and see one that I like, and I sit down and I'm like, ooh.
I can name one of them that if it's on, you gotta sit down and watch it.
You better not name it.
Forrest Gump.
Yeah, I knew.
Yep, see? You have a go-to movie.
Yeah, but that's not on a list.
No, it's a mental list.
Okay.
See? Yeah. So my go-to list, the top three are Ready Player One, Twister, and Unstoppable.
Oh, I didn't know it ranked that high on your
list. Yeah, I got a top three, and there's a top five, and then there's a top ten.
Well, what's the top five?
I don't know. I would have to sit and really think about that. But there is a top five and a top ten.
That's doubtful. Very doubtful.
Before we begin this episode, though, I'm going to warn everybody. We are in the process of feeding our little co-host, so you might hear some slurping noises or some enjoying noises coming from her every so often. Also with some heavy breathing, because we did not know how sensitive the mics were, and they were picking up the breathing as we were beginning, so this is going to be interesting.
Right? I didn't think bottle feeding was that intense, but apparently it is for little ones.
Yeah, apparently. That's great. So, Leslie, what have you been listening to?
I actually was listening to Awakenings by Randy Newman.
Oh, okay. That's a good score.
It is a very good score. It's a very good movie.
Now, that's Robin Williams and Robert De Niro, right?
Right. And it hits differently, of course, once you become a parent.
Oh, yeah.
Because Robert De Niro, has an episode, and, when he was a little boy, and he's been kind of comatose for a very long time. And then, right. When he comes to, it's like he's still a little boy.
Right.
Because he's still in that mindset. So, it hits differently when you become a parent. I watched a movie as a kid. And I've watched it growing up because I like that movie. But, thinking about it now as a parent is kind of heartbreaking.
Right. I remember flipping through one day and I saw Robin Williams and I'm like, okay, that's Robin Williams. And then I saw Robert De Niro. I'm like, wait, Robin Williams and Robert De Niro in a movie together? Like, what is this? So I caught it again and I watched it from the beginning. It was a very sad movie.
It's a sad movie based on a true story.
Yeah.
The score is really lovely. Randy Newman is a great composer. Mm-hmm. A lot of piano work and that sort of thing. In the score, I enjoyed it. I thought it was a good score. And it, of course, brought back memories of the movie. So.
Yeah. I've been going through... I was flipping around and I went to Peacock the other day and the, Fast and Furious 9 was on there. I hadn't seen that one. So I was like, I'll go back and I'll go and watch it. Never seen it. Oh my God. Completely unbelievable. Could not get over, the storyline that they were going for. I'm sorry, John Cena does not look like Vin Diesel's brother at all.
He looks like a buff Jim Varney.
He really does. And that was the problem, because I saw that meme where John Cena looks like an old Jim Varney, and I could not take the character seriously, because he was supposed to be the bad guy in this, right? So when he pops up on the screen, I'm just going, hey, Vern. You know what I mean? And I was just like...
The thing is, I bet you he could play in a Jim Varney biopic about Jim Varney.
I could see it. I could see it too. So, but hearing the score, it was a Brian Tyler score. Because Brian Tyler had been scoring all of them since Tokyo Drift, which is the third film, except for number 6. That was by Lucas Vidal. I can't really pronounce his name. But he used Brian Tyler's theme. So I've been going back, and I went to the very beginning and listened to The Fast and the Furious by BT. And it was a lot of drum and bass, synthesized hits and everything else. And then I just listened to a couple of tracks and then went on to the next one. And I've been listening to all of them. And I got to the second one. It was by David Arnold, who did Independence Day, which we covered.
Yes.
And it was... You got the drum and bass hits, but then he was bringing in the orchestra, and he was trying to incorporate a little bit more into it and everything else. And the thing I noticed when Brian Tyler came on for Tokyo Drift, it was immediately, there were themes, there were, you know, something big, huge, epic, and everything else. And the thing was, as more and more the films got complex and elaborate and everything else, the score was still solid all the way through. As you know, outlandish as these films have gotten, now the ninth one, they went to space. Not kidding. It was the two characters, Roman and Tej, in space flying a Pontiac Ferrero. Yes. But the overall the score is very solid for these movies. I mean, there's huge epic scenes, but there's themes that are coming in there, and they play throughout the series.
I can imagine it probably sounds more like position music than at that point.
Well, see, that's what I thought too. But when you hear it against the movie, it really does. It just sounds like, you know, just generic action music. But when you listen to it on its own, it's really got a lot of, you know, emotion going in
there. I'll have to check it out. I haven't.
The score is pretty good for the series. It was like Tokyo Drift and the fourth movie. They were trying to really do the Hans Zimmer style, but it was in Brian Tyler's own way, which worked. It really did work. But then it was, once you got the Fast Five, he really created his own style, really created his own theme, and it just played out throughout the rest of the series. That was pretty cool. So I am kind of excited to hear Brian's work for Fast X. The film, not so much. But I just want to see it just for Jason Momoa, because he looks like a insane villain, and I just thought that was pretty cool. So, but none of those have anything to do with the film we're going to be talking about today, which is Unstoppable.
About trains?
Well, I don't know. I take it back. Fast Five has a train in there. This is about a train.
There might be a link.
Maybe.
Maybe.
So, Unstoppable was done by Harry Gregson-Williams, which, again, is one of Hans Zimmer's people. Now, he did work as Hans Zimmer's assistant at one point, which was... There was a story I saw. I can't remember. I think I want to say it was the Spitfire Audio behind the scenes or something. There was an interview that was done with him. And he was talking and saying, like, if you're Hans Zimmer's assistant, you have to have every sound that Hans Zimmer has.
Oh, yes. I remember you telling me about
this. Yeah. So he said that Hans took him down to the bank, took out a loan, and that he was so afraid he was never going to be able to pay back, and had to buy all the exact same instruments and stuff that Hans Zimmer has.
Which, you know, that makes sense, though, because he's working with Hans Zimmer.
Right.
But you would think that Zimmer would have been gracious enough to buy him the instruments, since that's kind of technically quote unquote his.
That's
employee,
what I was wondering. That's why I was like,
that'd be like your employer, you know, at the news station, say, okay, Chris, we need you to buy your own cameras.
Right.
We need you to do production work, right?
When I when I heard that, I was just like, what?
Right. It seems kind of bizarre to me.
Yeah, a little bit. But the score, I was really excited about it because when I watched the film back in 2010 when it came out, the score was one of the things that I really noticed. It was very cool because everything about it invoked a train. And not to the point where it was, not to the point where he was using actual train sounds. It was to the point where he was using the orchestra or manipulating sounds to where it sounded like a train.
You are jumping ahead.
Not really. No.
Yeah, you're jumping ahead. You did a little hopscotch. Yeah, I never watched it, I don't think, when it first came out. So I didn't take note of the sound. You know, it was a few years later, I think, that I actually sat down and watched it. And still, I didn't really take note of the music because it was kind of ambient in the background.
I remember when I watched it in the theaters. It was really funny. It was me and my brother Jason. We were going to theaters, and it was one of those times where it was like we were going to go to watch two films at the same time. That way, you know, because it was a little distance to the theaters where we lived at. So we tried to time it where we go see two films. That way, you know, our parents would have to come back so soon to come back and get us. So we saw Skyline, which is what Jason wanted to see, and then Unstoppable, which is what I wanted to see. Jason did not want to see Unstoppable. He was just like, I'd rather see Skyline, man. I don't want to see Unstoppable. We go see Skyline. We ended up not liking the movie.
I've never watched that one at all.
It was not very good. Somehow or another, it spawned two sequels. I don't know how, because I did not enjoy the movie at all. Neither one of us did. So then he's like, all right, man, if Unstoppable sucks, I'm going to blame this on you. I'm just like, gee, thanks, man. So we're gonna watch it. Yeah. So we're gonna watch it, and we ended up loving the movie because it was a great cast, great story, and everything else. And then, like I said, being the film score buff, the score was the one thing that really, you know, stood out to me watching it.
So as you mentioned, it was released in 2010, and it had a $167.8 million box office. For
wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty big.
For its release.
That is pretty big.
That's a lot of money. I wish I had $167.8 million.
I wish I had $1 million.
That'd be great, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I would. I'll take a 20 grand. I wouldn't even take a million. 20 grand, I'd be happy.
Yeah. For the moment.
Yeah. 20 grand for the moment. Now that'll last us maybe like a couple of months, but you got 20 grand, it'd be good.
So the movie was inspired by the Crazy Eights train incident that happened in 2001. I didn't get an opportunity to look up that incident. Did you look up any information on what happened?
I did. And you know what? I think with this, we're going to talk about this when we get to the film part, because the true story is so similar to the film that it's uncanny that this actually happened.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah. So I'll tell the true story when we get to the film.
Okay.
But yeah, it is pretty cool though.
So the train in the movie was run by a remote control.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
So I guess they hooked it up to remote control so they could run it on the tracks to film the movie.
Yeah, I remember seeing the behind the scenes of that, and I mean, it was kind of weird because it was like a strap, like a guy was holding it with a strap, and it was like the strap made it where he could just put his hands right there and start controlling it, and I was like, what? Another fun fact, the scenes where you see Denzel and Chris Pine in the 1206 train, the showcase car, it had a cutout in the middle of it so the camera could dolly around the actors as they were talking.
Yeah, that makes sense because, you know, all the trains I've ever been in, it's very confined space.
It really is.
So I wonder if that's how they did the new movie with Brad Pitt, the one that we just watched recently.
Oh, with Bullet Train?
Right.
I bet you anything, a lot of that was CGI.
Oh,
a
you
lot
think
of it,
so?
Yeah.
You don't think it happened on a train?
Well, they probably had train exteriors and everything else, but I'm pretty sure that was on a set. A lot more CGI, because you could tell in some instances there was some CGI in Bullet Train.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, the other thing is that Denzel had a fear of heights, but he did his own stunts for part of the scenes, especially with him running on top of the train. He had 7 stuntmen, one for each day of the week.
Ooh. I can believe it.
Can you believe that?
Rosario Dawson is a real-life train aficionado.
That's awesome.
Yeah. She travels on trains all over the world whenever possible.
Well, you know, when I lived in Germany, public transportation is real big over there. I did a lot of train riding myself. And, you know, for us Americans, especially those that kind of live in the South, we don't have the public transportation that you would find in the rest of the world, especially in Europe and Asia. So, you know, my first experience of the train ride was pretty interesting because the sliding feeling you kind of feel on a train doesn't feel the same way as you would riding in a car.
Huh.
Yeah, it's got a different feel to it, or flying in a plane.
Crew members referred to this movie as the taking of Pelham 456 because it was the second consecutive movie directed by Tony Scott, starring Denzel Washington, featuring a train after the taking of Pelham 123. Which
that's funny.
Also had a score by Harry Gregson Williams.
Yeah, that's funny.
And if you listen to that score, there's a piece. I want to say the what was the name of it? Oh, The Lights Are All Green is the name of the track. If you listen to it, it sounds a lot like Unstoppable. There's a lot of the same elements and everything else, which was really cool.
Yeah. That's awesome.
So yeah. So I guess before we get into the rest of the trivia, how about we talk about the score?
Right. That's my next thing on my piece of paper right here. I have a ... score. So, you know, when I first started listening to the score, I was not really impressed by it. It kind of sounded, you know.
Or for like the Stanton PA track or whatever.
Well, just in general.
Yeah.
It's just the general sound. It sounded like a typical movie score. Nothing really stuck out. I noticed that there was a mix of orchestration with some percussive elements. You know, it seemed mellow. But as I started listening to it, you could hear the elements in the background that sounded like the train sounds.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I'm like, well, this is very intelligently done. You know, I've talked in the past about intelligent scores, putting in elements to your score from the scene or from like the movie that you're watching. So, for example, you know, if you had a movie you were filming in the woods, you know, in my mind, I would use a lot of woodwind or wooden chimes or, you know,
see, that's
locust
that's
sound, stuff that's, you know, kind of woody.
That's what you did when I was supposed to score a movie that was taking place with the woods. And you said, well, think about Unstoppable. They used, you know, it sounded like a train, you know. So why don't you do something like that? And that's what I did. Well, the movie never happened, but it still goes back to, you know, incorporate, you know, invoke the feeling. And that's
right.
Exactly what the score does.
And I thought it was really fascinating. And it was really subtle. And you could hear it kind of in the background, almost like the train whistle.
Yeah.
Or like the grinding of metal. Or you could hear it in the score.
Right.
And I thought that was, well, I can't speak today. Well done. I was going to say, right? Well done.
Well, there was one track. I want to say it might have been the Stanton PA track or the Frank Barnes track. But you hear something that sounds like the bells on a railroad crossing.
Right.
But it was done in a very rhythmic fashion. I thought that was genius.
The other thing I really liked is that the name of the pieces. Typically, when you listen to a score, you'll have just kind of generic names, with the exception of a few composers that like to take creative liberties.
Like Giacchino.
Right. very creative liberties with the name of the score. But this score here, I noticed that each piece had, or each person had their own motif, and it was named such in the score itself.
Right.
So you had, you know, Frank's motif, but it was separate. You know, you had Ned's motif, which was separate. Yes. We'll get into Ned.
And Ned, the character Ned, really did have a theme to him.
Right.
It was the slide guitar, the almost acoustic sound.
I thought that
sound.
Was pretty unique because I haven't seen anything like that so far in what we've been doing here on our podcast.
No.
And so when I started looking at the names, I'm like, well, this is pretty cool. And then you would hear it reoccurring then at that point throughout the score. So you would hear Frank's motif kind of reoccur, or you would hear, you know, Ned's theme kind of reoccur. And that kind of set up the movie in my mind before we watched a movie that, okay, he must be making an appearance in this scene,
right,
for this piece.
Now, as we talked about, he is a part of Hans Zimmer's group. Now, our last score we did, National Treasure, and Trevor Rabin was a part of Hans Zimmer's group. And, you know, one of the things we talked about with that was the use of the percussion going crazy and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah.
So, that was one thing I was kind of worried about, because watching the film, you would hear it. You would hear the percussion and everything else. And then going in and listening, it never went into the realm of
crazy.
Well, not really crazy. It was unlistenable.
Right.
Like,
it was pleasant.
It worked. It worked with the score.
It was really
now,
pleasant.
It did go crazy. It did have its moments where it goes.
But it was
nuts.
Controlled crazy,
exactly.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it was very controlled. It was very rhythmic. It worked. It worked with the orchestra.
It sounded purposeful also with the rest of the elements playing
exactly.
together.
Whereas National Treasure was all over the place in a lot of pieces, this one worked. This one, it was in line. It kept
right.
going. It kept going with the style, and it was enjoyable to listen to. I mean, granted, it was frantic. It was, you know, a little crazy in parts, but it worked.
Right.
It worked very well, and he would still incorporate, you know, a lot of the train sounds and everything else. It never went overboard.
It never went full crazy.
Exactly. until you get to the score piece, the Stanton Curve. Now, that is when you get the very loud, you know, guitar stab, which is straight up a ripoff. Well, not really ripoff. He really incorporated that from The Dark Knight, because Hans Zimmer did that for the Joker's theme.
He borrowed it.
There you go. He borrowed it. There we go. That works.
It was borrowed.
It was borrowed.
It wasn't intellectual property.
Exactly. And it really worked for that. I remember, you know, watching the film, and
right.
I remember hearing that.
It didn't sound too unrefined.
No.
It made sense. And now we're just talking about a score, not with a movie.
Right.
It made sense within the score or the universe of the that, you know, was created through the score. It didn't sound out of place.
No.
I didn't have any issues with any of the pieces that I listened to.
Right.
Like I said, you know, when I first started listening to it, that kind of sounded like, you know, this is a generic, not a generic, that's not the word I want to use. This is, you know, like a typical score, until I started hearing the other elements that he started adding for the train, and then seeing how everybody has their own separate motif, you know, separated and named piece throughout the score.
To me, I think there's like three main motifs throughout the whole score, and it's like the Frank and Will theme, and then you got Ned's theme. Well, all right, let's say four main motifs throughout the whole score. You got Will and Frank's motif, then you got Ned's motif, then you got the train's motif.
Right.
And he really did give the train a voice with the score.
Well, if you think about it, the train was the main antagonist.
Right.
Right? So, Of course, it makes sense for him to have a cue or
a sound
a sound.
or yeah. I mean, and yeah, and especially like with the Stanton Curve track, you know, you get this Dark Knight stab with the guitars and everything else, and then the guitars come in, you know, and you get this whole riff that just works. I thought it was really cool. I thought it was really enjoyable to listen
Really
to.
intelligently done.
Right.
You can tell
So,
he thought about it.
yeah, he re that. Thank you. He really gave a lot of thought to this score because, truthfully, it's a movie about an unmanned train barreling down the road, you know, barreling down the tracks, barreling down the road. Jeez.
What type of train are you talking
I
about?
am tired, people. So anyway, it's a train barreling down the tracks by itself. You could have really had a very generic score, and that is not what he
And
did.
that's what I thought it was initially when I started
Right.
listening to it.
And I'm not gonna lie, I could see how you would think that with the first couple of tracks because it's very Hans Zimmerish. You know, very action, like, okay, whatever. But then when the rest of the score starts coming in, you really get the sense of, oh, he's trying to do something here. He's trying to invoke the story. He's trying to help these characters out. And that's, you know, that's a sign of a good composer there. And I really like a lot of Harry Gregson Williams' work. He did Shrek with John Powell. He did a lot of the Tony Scott films with Denzel Washington, Man on Fire, Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3. He also did Deja Vu, which a lot of those had really good scores to them, but to me, Unstoppable was one that was very different. It was unique, very unique. Al along with the film was very unique itself.
Which we're about to get into,
Exactly.
right?
All right, so. The film is about a train engineer by the name of Dewey.
Oh, Dewey.
Yep.
Dewey, Dewey. I didn't realize how, I don't want to be very negative, but how a dunderhead he has been. And I watched the movie again, I'm like, how could you be so stupid?
Yeah, seriously. So he's played by Ethan Suplee before he lost all the weight, which the dude. Oh
Looks
man,
amazing,
he
yeah.
really does. I gotta give the dude credit. He
And that takes
really did,
dedication, especially to
because
lose that
this
amount of
guy was
weight.
huge, especially in Remember the Titans, which also starred Denzel Washington. But it's like the dude was huge. I mean, he was really big. And now, if you look at him, it's like dude's like nothing but muscle.
That's a lot of
There's a
dedication and a lot of
lot of
time and a lot of perseverance.
exactly.
It's not easy feat.
So the story, the way it goes, is the engineer sees a switch up ahead, and he gets out of the cab to flip the switch. Now, the way it's supposed to work, you're supposed to set the independent brake, and then you're supposed to have your air brakes as well. Well, the air brakes were not tied on at the beginning of the film, and then when he set the independent, he had to put the train in the power under notch 8. Okay, so he gets out of the cab. Next thing you know, it slips out. The independent brake slips out, and the train is under power, so it starts moving ahead. Well, he flips the switch, and then he can't get back onto the cab because he's very overweight. He can't make it on. He tries to get on. Train starts, you know, speeding down the tracks.
So, how does that differ from the Crazy Eight story?
All of it. All of it is, well, none of it differs, is what I meant. It's
You're like, all of it's different.
all of it's different. No, the story is exactly the way it really happened. Guy got climbed out of the cab. He's, you know, set all the independent. He did all that. The only thing that was different was this guy was dragged a few feet and he was hurt a little bit because when he tried to get back on, he was just holding on to the train and he was drugged for a little bit.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah, but, CSX has never given this guy an aim out. So, well, the film keeps going. You know, they're trying to find out different ways to stop the train and everything else. And that's when they realize that there are two. It's carrying two containers filled with molten phenol.
That's some nasty stuff.
Oh yeah,
You know,
so.
you'd be surprised with how much chemicals that the trains do carry. You know, I have my DOT certification. I'm hazmat certified for the line of work that I do. Because, you know, I've discussed this before. I'm a geologist by trade, but I do a lot with environmental science, a lot of hazardous waste
and
management.
And now we get into science time with Leslie.
My point is, is that there are a lot of chemicals that these trains carry that we don't really think about. The hazard levels of these chemicals. You know, I have an example when I was working on the BP oil spill. We had one here overturn. It spilled a bunch of refrigerant.
Ooh.
And we had a lot of people that got sick, especially those that were out of town that were working in an oil spill that was in the area. They did an evacuation because the refrigerant was toxic. And we had a lot of people ended up in hospital because of it.
Now, you looked this up. The molten phenol, if it exploded, you would have to evacuate over half a mile, right?
Right. So the ERG stated half of a mile in all directions in the event that part of the train or part of the cargo that is carrying it catches on fire. The problem is that with molten phenol, for my science folks out there, if you're listening, it produces hydrogen gas. And hydrogen gas is
highly flammable.
It's explosive.
I mean, that is it's scary like a bomb. Stuff. So this train was carrying, which they use that line in the movie. We're not talking about a train. We're talking about a missile the size of the Chrysler Building. Now, although that was a great trailer line, it is really scary as to how true that is.
It can be, right.
And I mean, that and it's just scary to think about that.
Right. And then, you know, you think about we've got all these train tracks. You know, we've got train tracks close to the
right.
house. So what if we had something happen close to the house?
Oof.
We can't close all of our windows here because no. our house is very airish. You know, we've
right.
got draft areas. So, you know, think about that.
Yeah.
So you have this train that's got all these chemicals that are barreling towards these heavily populated areas. So it
yeah.
is really scary.
And the whole thing with the molten phenol, that was not created for the film. That was part of the true story. So there's true fact number two. So the film keeps going and you get Rosario Dawson's character, Connie Hooper. She's like the one of the people in charge of the yard there at, I want to say it was Brewster or Fuller Yard. And so they're trying to get all the trains off the tracks. And then Ned, the wonderful character Ned, he's a welder.
I love Ned because every time you see him, he's peeling out. Well, and right, even so if he's not peeling out.
He's not just peeling out. He's peeling out in a dually.
Right. And you got rocks flying.
A dually pickup truck. And this guy is flinging it sideways every time we turn around. And
and there's one that I noticed. It was like a soft peel out. It wasn't really fast, but it was still a peel out. It looked like he was fishtailing a little bit. And
yeah.
I'm like, what are you doing?
It's great. I love Ned. Ned's played by Lou Temple.
That's my favorite, I think, character of
yeah.
the whole movie.
So Ned, if you haven't seen this movie, seriously, you're going to love Ned. So Ned is running late that day. So Connie calls Ned and was like, hey, you know, I need you to go throw the switch and everything else. Well, the train's already passed. That's when they realize that the train's under power. This is when the danger and Henry Gregson's his music really starts to shine.
Right. And I have that in my notes I didn't mention before that I noticed that there was a tempo pickup when it was the not a coaster
right.
piece. And we see that in the movie. So when Ned shows up and they realize that it's not a coaster, you can hear the music start to pick up tempo.
I love that moment too, because Connie's like yelling at Dewey, like, you know, Dewey, you know, I need you to rally every cell in your brain. You know, was the, you know, what position was the power?
And he didn't want to tell her at
and
first.
He was like, oh, it was in notch 8. Another part of the true story, notch 8. So he was like, you know, it was in notch 8, and you could just see, like,
her face drain of
yeah,
color,
her face
right?
drain. She's like, oh, God, we've really got a problem now. And then you see her jump up, and that's when the music picks up.
So, you know, this whole time is that it was a nice intro to the music. It was really kind of ambient in the background. I liked it because it made it easier to hear the dialogue, you know, because you do sometimes have instances where you have music that overpowers the actors, or even the sound mixer, whoever does the sound mixing, don't do it right, and you can't hear the dialogue very well.
Yeah, and never once did the music overpower anything.
It fit nicely, and there were some instances I forgot that it was playing. I don't mean that in a bad way, but it just fit the movie so well that it kind of melded with everything
nicely. It really fit the narrative.
Right. So the first score piece with Dewey, when the train gains momentum, that was a nice fit. It didn't deviate from, you know, what he started with. And I felt like the music did add that suspenseful nature to the movie.
Right.
Especially with the suspenseful parts. Unlike, you know, last time we did National Treasure, and those, like, foot chase scenes were kind of all uncontrolled, out of place, too intense. It wasn't in this movie. It actually fit the speeding train, with the exception of one part, and that was with the helicopter.
Okay, yeah, we're going to get to that one in just a second. So the film keeps going, and it's going through this whole thing with Denzel and his character and everything else, and this one part in particular I really, really liked is when you see Denzel's face. He's like, they're going along. He's like, you need to go off the main. They're like, well, why? You know, there's a train. He's like, on our track, you know, like, you know, I'm sorry. If I was a train engineer or conductor and I'm in there and they tell me that an unmanned train is barreling towards me, I would just start freaking out.
You'd be like Chicken Little, the sky is falling.
No, I don't know if I'd be like Chicken Little. I just know I'd be freaking out. I would probably be more like Chris Pine, not Denzel.
You should have wore your brown pants that day, right? You might have a little accident.
Just a little bit, just a little bit. So then you get this whole sequence where the CEO of the railroad company has this idea to dangle a guy, well, have a train get in front of the 777 is the name of it, and slow the train down for someone to land from a helicopter onto 777 to get inside and stop it and slow it down.
Now, did that really happen for the Crazy Eights?
No. Now, yeah, that was another thing. The name of the train for the incident was Crazy Eights. Was the name of it, which to me sounds a little bit more menacing than 777.
Well, they can't use Crazy Eights because it's a real incident, right?
Yeah, I guess so.
That's based on a true story.
Yeah, 777 though.
They'd Crazy have to get Eights. Permission.
Yeah, and maybe CSX was like, "No, we don't want that. No, we're good." All right. So during this sequence, there is a change in the score.
I noticed it right away. I'm like, this is strange. This sounds like horror strings.
So when I watched the movie, and it really did invoke the horror of the scene, you know, like this guy's being dangled and he's dragging through the glass and everything else. But at the same time, it just didn't fit with the rest of the score.
Right. It didn't fit with the rest of the score. But then it led me, you know, to think, okay, we noticed it because we were looking for different score changes, right? I don't know if, you know, regular moviegoer watching the movie would have noticed that.
So, for the longest time, I could not figure out what that, you know, I couldn't ever figure out, you know, why they did that. Why Harry Gregson goes through this whole thing, then he has this one scene where the music was just completely off. But it worked for the scene, but it was very different. I didn't realize it until, like, years later. I'm listening to the Alien vs. Predator score by Brian Tyler. It was Alien vs. Predator Requiem. And it's, like, one of the, there's got, like, National Guard Part 1 and Part 2 tracks. It was one of those. I'm listening to it, and I heard it. They used parts of the score from Alien vs. Predator Requiem in Unstoppable.
Really?
Yeah, that's why it had the horror elements you were talking about. That's why it sounded like it was
horror. Horror strings.
Right. Which makes sense. But like I said, it could have been one of those instances where they used it as temp music. Now, this happened with Scream 2. They used the theme from Broken Arrow by Hans Zimmer. And everybody liked it so much, they just ended up keeping it in the film. And Marco Beltrami ended up really in encompassing that theme into the score. So that could have been one of the things right there. They could have been, you know, like, hey, we really like this, we're just going to keep it in there.
But it kind of, to me, it broke up the continuity.
It really did.
Everything going around it.
Yeah, it did. It just didn't work.
No.
Now, I mean, judging it by the score and the rest of the film, you know, sitting there watching it, it works. It's fine. But when you're judging it, like we're doing, you really notice it.
So I didn't know if, you know, maybe a normal moviegoer that is oblivious to things like that would even notice the score change there. But it was noticeable to me.
Yeah, definitely. So then Denzel and Chris Pine, I'll just say Denzel and Captain Kirk decided to... The rear knuckle on the train was left open, so they decided to take their train, back it up, go in reverse, like 60 miles an hour in reverse, to hook up to the back of 777 and try to brake it in the other direction. You know, pull it in the other direction and brake and slow it down so that somebody can get on board and stop it.
And that's amazing to me because I have problems just backing up in a car, let alone a train.
I can attest to this. She really does.
Hey now, this is not, let's make fun of Leslie Day. But no, I mean, it would be simpler on a train because you can't, you're on a track. So, right. I mean, when you go backwards, it's just like, no, you're going backwards straight.
Now, I thought that would be something that they embellished for the film. And no, that is how they stopped.
Really?
Crazy Eights. That is insane. Now, the person, I don't want to give his name. Now, the guy who really did this ended up being a consultant for the film, which is pretty cool. But yeah, they hooked up and then gunned it in the opposite direction, slowed it down to 11 miles an hour, and then another engineer was able to hip on.
Oh, hip on this train?
I want hip on this train.
Hip, hop, hippity, hippity, hip, hop, hop.
Don't do that. Do not do that on this podcast. So anyway, the engineer was able to hop onto the train and slow Crazy H down.
So now, the train derailleur part didn't happen?
Okay, so there was a scene where they had a portable derailleurs and ended up the derailleurs did not work. That's the whole reasoning for Denzel and Captain Kirk to hook up to the back, you know, because he's like, the portable derailleurs are not going to work. And they're like, oh, you know, the CEO, the moron, he's like, oh, no, that's why they're calling a portable derailleur and all this. They ended up not working. That really happened. And with Crazy Eights, it shredded all the portable derailleurs and everything else.
Well, if you think about it, the train's going so fast, and the laws of physics, yeah.
And Connie said the line of, you know, it's 2 million pounds of train, you know, of course it's going to shred through it.
Well, think about it. You got your laws of physics, so you've got the initial first part of the train going X number of speed. All the subsequent cars are going that same number of speed. So,
right.
If it went to go stop, then you'd have those subsequent cars still going that speed that the train's
right.
going.
Right.
It's not possible.
All right. I thought when I found out that the story was pretty much exactly the same as the film, I thought it was amazing.
I think so, too, because you have a lot of instances, especially in Hollywood, where they take liberties with the original story.
For example, I just watched Tetris with Taron Egerton. Great film.
As soon as you said that, the theme song of Tetris just popped in my head.
So I don't want to get a copyright infringement. So it was a really good film, really well acted, great story and everything else. Come to find out, I want to say maybe 75 to 80% of it didn't happen the way that happened in real life.
Yeah, that's why I always look up a story. If you get a movie and it says based on a true story, then I want to read what the true story is.
And with this film, there were a lot of embellishments, like the whole part with the guy dangling from the helicopter, the whole train full of, you know, school kids, the horse trailer, the Stanton curve. None of that happened.
Well, of course not, because it didn't occur in Pennsylvania. Was it Ohio?
It occurred in Ohio, and the original script was Montana.
Somewhere,
yeah. It was Montana, but Tony Scott said that it didn't have a sense of danger to it.
They'd be like, let's have this in Kansas, where there's nothing.
It's all flat.
All flat.
Yeah, all flat. All flat. I thought the score was the movie was great. I really do. I thought the score and the movie were great, but all right. So watching this, can you see why this is a part of my top three of go-to films?
Yeah, you've got that chase, action, adventure type of heisty. It's not a heist, of course, no. But that feel, you know, that adrenaline rush feel is what I'm trying to go for. Rush. Right.
It's just fun. Right. It's a fun movie. It's one of those you can turn your brain off and watch, but it's not dumb like Fast and the Furious.
Not about streetcar racing.
It's
anymore.
Not about family.
It was about his family.
For family.
Right.
God,
Denzel weird. Called his family.
Which is funny because they offered Denzel Washington the role in Furious 7, the role that Kurt Russell took. He turned it down.
I don't blame him. You've got this wonderful actor that's got this, you know, repertoire of all these wonderful, in-depth characters, and you're going to put him in Fast and Furious. I don't see that happening.
Which even Kurt Russell just does not fit in those movies, but whatever. So, with that being said, I guess it's time for us to get through our criteria. So, number one, does the score work for the film?
Absolutely. I think it does. As I mentioned, it adds that suspenseful element to those suspenseful parts. It doesn't overpower any part of the movie. You could hear the dialogue. It helps build tension where it needs to. I think it works perfectly for the film.
I'll say it like this. The score that Harry Gregson Williams created
works
for the film. But in a judging sense, the score that they put in there for the scene where the helicopter, it doesn't quite work in a judging sense. But if you're just sitting there watching it, it works. It's fine. Now, there was only one scene I could think of where I thought there maybe should have had a little bit more score. And we'll talk about that in a second. To me, the score worked.
Right.
It worked. It did its job. It really, really told a story. I love the themes that he come up with. And
right. I love the themes. They were, especially Frank's theme, it was one of my favorite pieces. Which
I love that piano. Right. Love the piano when it comes in. So then we're going to talk about favorite scene or favorite score.
And I just mentioned Frank's piece. Okay. I really liked his score piece. And you could hear it kind of modeled throughout the movie, especially when he's in a scene, you can hear it. It's really nice. Of course, my favorite part of the movie is with Ned always peeling out. Anytime you see the back end of his truck and you see it fishtailing and rocks flying. And I just really liked that part about the movie, especially at the beginning when you see him. He was kind of womanizing this waitress at the beginning, right?
Yeah, he's sitting there talking about, he's like, I'm not talking about if you're spot welding so-and-so. It's all about precision. He's always talking about precision.
Right.
Every single time. And he's like doing the interview with the people at the end of the movie. He's like, we were in our comfort zone. It's all about precision. It's like,
it was
really
funny. Yeah, really? he was a fun character.
To me, it was. I really liked the scenes with Ned, but I really liked the Stanton Curve track, and I loved it when it played in the movie. That was really fun. Leading up to that scene, though, where Chris Pine's character goes out to try to help gauge the distance of the two trains, and his foot gets caught and everything else, and he's like dangling and everything else, which Chris Pine...
grain flying
everywhere. Yeah, you got grain flying everywhere, and he's all dangling, which he really did all of his own stunts, by the way.
That's amazing.
And, but it was, there was like a little bit of music for when the grain car blew. You get this weird sound twice, and then after that, there's really no score there. When he's dangling and everything else, there's nothing. There's no sense of danger and everything else. Watching it and judging it, I'm just like...
So that's what you would have done differently.
I would have done that differently. But... I don't know. It was just something about that one scene.
You just felt like it needed to score.
Right. And so, judging on our third criteria, you know, what could have been done differently, that would have been what I could have done differently.
Well...
to me. Now, the rest of the score, everything worked, you know, that Henry Gregson Williams did... but that one scene right there, it was a little off to me.
I would have actually changed the score piece for the train coming up alongside the other train, you know, the harp strings.
Yeah.
Because that really did stand out to me. Now, there was a part of the movie that stood out to me that I thought was jarring. It was when Frank's teenage daughters were watching, I guess, a music video on the TV.
Yeah.
And to me, that... I think it was just, you know, that was a movie choice. It wasn't a score choice. But, you know, the music playing on the TV, the music video that they were watching was kind of jarring to me. But score-wise, the score piece for the helicopter coming down, you know, those horror strings, that to me needed to be changed to fit the ambiance of the rest of the score.
And another thing that does not... anything to do with the score, it's more the sound design. Whenever you see 777, you hear an animal noise. And it's like a growl or, you know, whatever.
A groaning sound.
Yeah, a groaning kind of sound. I mean, I get it. They're trying to add to the menacing nature of the train. Because, I mean, that's a scary thing. This train, there's nobody in the cab. And it's just barreling down the, you know, barreling down the tracks. Obliterating everything in its path. Yeah, I mean, you gotta add a little something with the sound design, but they used it to the point where it was too much in a lot of instances. I'm just like, okay, you ain't gotta, come on, we get it. It's scary. Okay, there's nobody in it. Just come on, take it out. Don't have it in there so much.
They probably were time crunching. Just leave it in there. We don't have time.
Oh, whatever. Just,
we gotta release the movie.
So, yeah, does the score work for the film? Yes, it does. All the score that was made. Now, favorite scene, we talked about those, and, you know, what could have been done differently. I talked about that one scene right there with, you know, Chris Pine dangling. Leslie talked about the where they used the AVPR score by Brian Tyler. Yeah. I mean, I get where you're going with that one.
Right.
So, those are our thoughts on Unstoppable. Great movie, great score. I had a lot of fun doing this because I was just not expecting a lot of the train elements that he put in there. I mean, because I've heard the score millions of times, but I haven't sat there and really, you know, listened to it like I did for this exercise. I thought it was fun.
I did too. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Yeah. So, our next episode, you're going to be...
It's my favorite. I picked it.
The Goonies by David Grusin. This is going to be fun.
It is. It's my favorite movie.
Well, it's going to be fun because from what I remember, the score was very fun. You know what? I'll save it for the next episode.
Oh, you tease.
So... you guys, you can reach out to us on social media, like always, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Leslie Mann's Facebook. I do Twitter and Instagram. I've been trying to incorporate some new videos and stuff on Instagram, trying out some new things for you guys. You know, let me know what you think, if the designs are cool and stuff like that, or if you just like want me to go back to the old stuff. Yeah, just let me know.
Let us know what you think about the Unstoppable score if you've listened to it. You can leave us a comment on Facebook. You can send us an email at, what's this, the email address?
The email address is measuringthescore@gmail.com. You can contact us on Twitter at @measurethescore. Instagram, just type in Measuring the Score Podcast. I'm pretty sure you're going to find us. Same with Facebook, Measuring the Score Podcast. We'll be on there somewhere. Or just do a Google search. We can't talk. We're tired. We're parents.
We're new
now.
Parents. We're tired.
New parents. We're tired. I have to work tomorrow. I'm not looking forward to it.
Wah. I still have 1 week left in maternity leave. Yes.
I don't like you right now.
And then I go back to work next week.
Bye. Yeah. That's what you get. But yeah, you can do a Google search, type in Measuring Score Podcast. You'll find us. Yeah. So, you got anything else?
No, that's it.
No, I think that's all right. I think I'm done too.
Good.
So, as always, for Measuring Score, I'm Chris.
And I'm Leslie.
Have a good one.